You said that he'd be a fine match for our Maddie? Yes, that's what it was. But if you think I should burn it...
Mother dove across the room like a hungry hawk.
Give that to me,
she said, snatching the paper away. She read it hastily.
This is the best news in weeks. Pernilla Ogilvy has invited us to afternoon tea, Matilda.
She read the invitation again.
Oh, good heavens, she wants us there today.
We can't go to tea today, I said. The shop is too busy. We can't close up or turn away customers. Besides, the Ogilvy girls are snobs. Why would they invite us except to make fun of our dresses? I'm staying here.
We would make time for tea at the Ogilvy's if they held it at midnight, said Mother. Be sensible, Matilda. Think of their young Edward.
I was thinking of their young Edward. That's why I'm not going. Grandfather stepped between us.
Matilda,
he said in a honey voice.
Of all the maids in our city, surely you deserve a day of rest. A day to drink tea and eat sweet cakes. But if you must stay here, I'm sure your mother and Eliza would be able to find a suitable list of chores to keep you from boredom. You know how they detest idleness.
The kettles, I thought. They'll make me scour the kettles again. My hands ached at the thought.
And I've heard their cook excels at pastries. Don't give their young Edward a thought. Enjoy yourself. Let your mother enjoy herself. I will direct the replacement troops here at the coffee house.
Mother looked at the old man. He just wanted a quiet afternoon, that much was clear. I saw him wink at her. I didn't know which one made me angrier, but somehow they had both won. Fine, I said. We'll go to tea. Huzzah! As soon as I conceded defeat, Mother turned her attention to the most important issue, tea-drinking clothes. We had tea-buying clothes, tea-brewing clothes, and tea-serving clothes, but we had no taking tea with the Ogilvy's clothes. Mother's solution lay in the bottom of the trunk in our chamber. She would wear her unfashionable ivory-colored gown, last seen at a victory ball after the war. She said it only had a few stains and fit well. At least she didn't run to fat like some she could name. That was that. Finding the proper clothes for me was another matter entirely. I could wear my church petticoat, but I needed a proper short gown to cover the bodice. My one fancy short gown was too small, and I hadn't filled out enough to wear any of Mother's cast-offs.
You'll have to wear the old one, she said. I'll let out the side seams as far as they can go. Perhaps Eliza can do something with your hair.
You are determined to make this as unpleasant as possible, aren't you? I asked. For once, my short-tempered answer did not rile her. Pretend you're in France, dear. She said lightly. The ladies there always do their hair. Eliza's idea of a hairstyle began with brushing me bald. The more I whimpered, the harder she tugged. In the end, I bit my lip and sulked. I'll sit nicely at the table, I said, but you can't force me to talk to their young Edward. Hush. Mother stitched my dress as fast as she could, her needle flashing in and out of the fabric like a bumblebee darting through flowers.
It's not too early to search for a suitable man. With your manners, it could take years. Edward Ogilvy has 4 older brothers. A bride with an established business like the coffee house is the best he can hope for.
You make it sound like I'm one of Mrs. Epler's chickens ready for market. Ow! Eliza, won't you be finished soon?
Have patience and keep your head still, she said. If you cared for your hair properly, I wouldn't have to wrestle it.
Nobody was on my side. I crossed my arms over my chest and pouted. I don't know which is worse, banishing me to the Luddington farm or marrying me off to an Ogilvy. Eliza combed through a lock of hair stuck together with dried jam.
You're a few years away from a trip to the altar, Maddie, and you are too soft to live in the country, she said. You have city hands and a weak back. You wouldn't last a week on the farm.
Your confidence is overwhelming, I said. She tugged my hair hard and tied it in a green and gold ribbon.
That's the best I can do, she said. If we had more time, we could try to curl it.
No! I covered my head with my arms. I like straight hair, and I don't need a husband to run the coffee house, Mother. You don't have one.
Try this on, and don't be vulgar, Mother said as she broke the thread with her teeth. You'll marry one day, don't you worry. Just pray that when you do, your husband won't be fool enough to fall off a ladder and break his neck when he's but 35 like your father did. The last thing this family needs is another miserable spinster.
Eliza pulled the laces of my stays, cutting off my reply. I gasped and saw tiny black dots. By the time they had tightened, pinned, and locked me into my clothes, I could feel my stomach rubbing against my backbone. Mother pulled my arms back until my shoulder blades touched, the proper posture for a lady.
She looks like a china doll,
observed Grandfather as we departed. I will break just as easily, I muttered. Chapter 7 August 30th, 1793. Wit is the most dangerous talent you can possess. It must be guarded with great discretion and good nature. Otherwise, it will create you many enemies. John Gregory, A Father's Legacy to His Daughters, 1774. I had to breathe in short puffs as we waited at the front door of the Ogilvy mansion. The stays bit into my stomach, and my shift was already sweat-soaked. If this was how the upper class felt all the time, no wonder they were all so cross. Mother tugged at my bodice to straighten it.
Try not to look so pained, she said. We won't stay long. Knowing your grandfather, he'll be giving away the silver on the street corner when we return.
She licked her thumb and wiped a smudge of dirt off my cheek.
You might turn out to be a beauty after all, she said. You've grown so quickly. I want the best for you.
I looked at her closely, unaccustomed to the gentle tone of her voice. Mother bent down suddenly to brush off the bottom of her gown.
Look at this dust, she exclaimed. When I was young, my family had a lovely carriage, and we always rode to tea. We arrived fresh and clean.
She turned around and swatted the hem of my skirt. The door opened, and an Ogilvy maid stared at the backside of my grumbling mother.
"Ma'am?" she asked.
Mother stood up hastily.
"Mrs. William Cook, Jr., and Miss Matilda Cook are here for tea with Mrs. Ogilvy," she told the maid. "The invitation arrived this morning."
The maid showed us into a drawing room as large as the entire first floor of the coffee shop. The long windows were covered with shimmering damask curtains. A crystal chandelier hung over a gleaming mahogany table, around which were clustered a half-dozen Chippendale chairs. Very expensive.
"Lucille! My dear Lucille! How wonderful to see you!" exclaimed Prunilla Ogilvy.
She sailed across the room like a man of war, showing the brocaded tips of her shoes and layers of lace-trimmed, starched petticoats. Her over-powdered hair left a trail behind her that settled like smoke on the carpet. Mother's face sagged as she took in Pernilla's gown of gunpowder gray silk, striped with white and blue. Her hand strayed to a stubborn coffee stain just over her hip.
"I'm so glad you could come," Pernilla continued. "I'm about to die from lack of company."
"Good afternoon, Pernilla. It was very kind of you to invite us. Allow me to present my daughter, Matilda."
I curtsied slightly, conscious of the few threads barely holding me together. "It's a pleasure to meet you, ma'am," I said.
"Oh, poor little Matilda. I recall your father well.
He was such a handsome man, would have gone far if he had been educated. But it won't do to think about tiresome things today. I declare, this has been the worst summer of my life, and I'm counting on you both to lighten my mood.
She squeezed Mother's arm. Mother gritted her teeth.
I'm parched. Let's have tea, and I'll tell you all about this wonderful house that Robert built for me.
Mrs. Ogilvy rang a tiny bell on the sideboard.
Girls?
The Ogilvy daughters, Colette and Jeanine, swept into the room, dressed in matching pink and yellow bombazine gowns, wearing their curled hair piled on top of their heads. I should have let Eliza curl my hair. Dash it all. Colette was the oldest. Her skin was as pale as clean ice, and dark circles ringed her eyes. Jeanine's head only came up to my shoulder, but she looked 16 at least. Her cheeks shone pink and chubby as a baby pig's. Jeanine whispered something into Colette's ear. Colette closed her eyes briefly, then snapped them open again. I wondered why she was so tired. No doubt exhausted from being waited on hand and foot. The mothers sat down first, then Colette and Jeanine flopped carelessly onto the Chippendale chairs. I sat carefully, so as not to pop any stitches. After two servants brought in silver trays of rolls and bite-sized frosted cakes, Mrs. Ogilvy poured the tea.
"Colette and Jeanine have just finished lessons with their French tutor," Mrs. Ogilvy said. "Are you studying French, Matilda?"
Mother jumped in before I could open my mouth.
"You know how old-fashioned my father-in-law is, Pernilla. He prohibits French, no matter how much I implore him. You are so fortunate to have an understanding husband. Do your sons study French as well?"
"Of course. We've had the French ambassador here to dine any number of times."
While Mrs. Ogilvy recounted what she thought was a hilarious story about
Monsieur l'Ambassadeur,
I tried to reach the cake plate. My fingers fell just short. If I stretched all the way across the table, the seam under my arm would split open. Jeanine saw my dilemma, picked up the plate, and passed it in the opposite direction to her mother.
"Why, thank you, dear. How kind," said Mrs. Ogilvy.
She chose three cakes and handed the plate to Mother, who took two. As Mother handed the plate to Colette, it tilted and the cakes slid to the floor. A tiny dog with a red ribbon between its ears rushed in and gobbled the fallen cakes. My stomach rumbled.
"So, tell me, Lucille, what have you been doing for company this tedious August?"
Pernilla asked.
"Everyone, simply everyone, has rushed out to their country retreats. It is most annoying."
I struggled to keep a straight face as I pictured Mother amidst the weeds, horseflies, and dead mice in our garden. Mrs. Ogilvy prattled on.
"President Washington and Martha will soon leave for Virginia, of course. The Nortons and Hepstrudels are in Germantown, and my own sister took her family to New York. Did you know that I planned a gala ball, and only two families responded? The rest of society has vanished."
Jeanine unfolded a silk fan and waved it, blowing a cloud of curls off her forehead. Shielding her mouth from her mother with the fan, she stuck her tongue out at me. Her wretched dog nipped at my shoe under the table.
"The only people left in Philadelphia seem to be shopkeepers and wharf rats. Robert has an appointment with the mayor this very day to insist that he put an end to the rumors of yellow fever."
"I heard a man died of the fever in the middle of the street, and three black crows flew out of his mouth," said Jeanine.
"Don't be vile, Jeanine," snapped her mother. "Those filthy refugees and creatures who live in the crowded hovels by the river, they're always sick with something. But it is a gross injustice that my gala should suffer because the lower class falls ill. Don't you agree, Lucille?"
Mother struggled to keep the smile on her face as she changed the subject.
"Are your sons still in town, Pernilla?"
she asked. Janine's eyebrows went up and her mouth opened. Why did Mother have to be so obvious in her intent? Why not just hang a signboard around my neck? "Available, foul-mouthed daughter."
"All of my brothers are away at school, Mrs. Cook," Janine answered quickly. "It's a shame they aren't here to meet you, Matilda. I'm sure you would amuse one of them."
I flinched.
"Colette has recently become engaged to Lord Garthing's son," Janine continued. "The gala was to have celebrated the engagement. Have you been courted yet, Matilda?"
"Matilda is a bit young for suitors," interjected Mother. "But I must congratulate you on your good fortune, Colette. When is the wedding to be held?"
Colette dabbed her napkin on her forehead.
"Mama, it is rather warm in here."
"Colette always flushes when we discuss the wedding. She is such a delicate creature. Sensitive nerves."
Mrs. Ogilvy had icing on the end of her nose.
"Colette tried to avoid our lesson this morning by complaining of a mysterious illness," tattled Janine. "She just wants to lie about and read dreadful novels."
"Has any of your sons found a bride?" asked Mother, determined not to let her subject slip away. Mrs. Ogilvy poured out another cup of tea.
"We have many discussions, as you might imagine. My children are a blessing, to be sure, but it requires a great effort to secure the future of each one."
Janine picked up the last cake on her plate, slowly bit into it, and licked the icing off her fingers.
"Mother," I said through my teeth, "we did not belong here. I did not belong here. Mother may have grown up with carriages and gowns, but I had not. I had to clasp my hands in my lap to keep from slapping Janine or shaking the life out of her mangy dog."
Mother ignored me and plowed ahead.
"Has any of your sons shown an interest in business?"
Colette brought her teacup to her lips but spilled the tea into her lap. Mrs. Ogilvy didn't notice.
"Trade," she replied. "Robert thinks that our sons should go into law or banking. Trade is hardly suitable for someone of our background."
Janine threw her fan down on the table.
"Oh, Mama, must you be so thick-headed? Mrs. Cook is asking if you might consider Miss Cook as a wife for one of our brothers, and I imagine their filthy little tavern is part of the deal."
I stood so quickly that the seams under my arms ripped open with a snarl. The dog barked shrilly.
"It's not a tavern. It's a coffee house," I said.
"Grog shop,"
taunted Janine. At that insult, my mother rose. A grog shop was where criminals and other dregs of society gathered to drink whiskey and fight.
"A coffee house," Mother explained. "With respectable customers who mind their manners far better than you."
"Oh, girls, ladies,"
fluttered Mrs. Ogilvy. Colette grasped the edge of the table and pulled herself to her feet, knocking over the cream pitcher.
"I fear," she said, panting heavily.
We all turned to stare at her.
"Sit down, Colette," said Janine. "I fear,"
Colette tried again.
"Pernilla, that girl does not look well,"
said Mother.
"I'm burning,"
whispered Colette. She crumpled to the flowered carpet in a faint. While Mrs. Ogilvy shrieked, Mother knelt down and laid the back of her hand against Colette's forehead.
"The fever!"
Chapter 8. September 2nd, 1793. I smelled the breath of death for the first time since all this hardship began, and was scared. Diary of J. Henry C. Helmuth, Philadelphia, 1793. From the time that Colette Ogilvy collapsed, the church bells of Philadelphia tolled without cease. Guns were fired on the street corners, and a cannon blasted in the public square to purify the air. On top of that, we suffered the constant buzz of mosquitoes, blowflies, and hornets. The din was maddening. The day after our ill-fated tea party, Mother sent a note to the Ogilvies inquiring about Colette's health, but received no response. They had disappeared. She also sent a note to the Luddingtons. No word from them either, thank heavens. Many of the wealthy families were fleeing. We were lucky to get 4 or 5 customers a day. Mother worried even more than usual, but I was too hot to care. A violent thunderstorm on Sunday cleared the air for a few hours, but when the sun came out on Monday, it baked the streets until the rainwater rose in ghostly plumes of steam. I felt like a noodle overboiled in a stew pot. And the bells continued to toll.
"I'm going to climb the church tower and cut the tongues out of those bells myself," Eliza grumbled as she beat a dozen eggs. "Hand me the nutmeg, child."
I passed her the small grater.
"Don't you have something to do?" she asked. "It's hot enough in here without an extra body breathing on me. What did your mother say before she left?"
"I'm waiting for Grandfather to finish his business in the necessary. He said I could go with him to the newspaper office." Eliza scowled and waved a towel at the flies buzzing above the bowl.
"Pick me some fresh asparagus grass. These pests are a plague."
The bright sun blinded me as I stepped outdoors. The garden looked distressingly poor, even with all the watering I had done and the brief rain. It was a good thing we were able to buy at the market. The asparagus grass grew along the back fence. I gathered a handful of fronds, cut them at the base, and tied the bunch tightly with a piece of twine. Back in the kitchen, I stood on a chair and hung them from an iron hook in the center ceiling beam. "There," I said, pushing the chair back against the wall. "That should discourage the flies."
"Thank you. Taste this pudding and tell me if it's right."
I chewed and pondered. "It needs more sugar."
"You think everything needs more sugar?"
Eliza wiped the sweat off her face with a handkerchief.
"I think that tea with the Ogilvy sisters affected you. Maybe you would be right for their Edward."
She stirred the fire and lay on more wood.
"Wasn't that long ago, folks didn't have any sugar. No coffee or tea, either."
"Please, Eliza, not another history lesson. I'll scream." Eliza harumphed and set the pudding over the fire.
"Don't know which is worse, you moaning or your mother staring out the window, hoping someone will walk in and lay a shilling on the table. We have ugly days ahead of us. No sugar for anyone, rich or poor. No, no."
I fanned myself with the wooden spoon. "Grandfather says this trouble will soon be over. He says people don't have gumption anymore." Eliza mumbled something under her breath that I couldn't quite hear. When it came to strong-headed opinions, Eliza, my mother, and my grandfather were evenly matched. She untied her apron and hung it from the hook.
"Where are you going?" I asked. "Grandfather and I could run any errand you need."
"Not this errand you couldn't."
Eliza reached for her pretty straw hat.
"The Free African Society is having a meeting about the fever. It should prove a lively gathering. I'll return in time for supper."
Out back, the door of the necessary slammed.
"Maddie Cook,"
called Grandfather.
"Must I wait all day?"
Andrew Brown's print shop smelled of ink and grease and the sweat of muscular apprentices carrying trays of lead type from the composing table to the printing press. When I was a child, Mr. Brown let me pick out letters and set them in the form. It had been a thrill seeing my words in print. The printer issued no invitation to me that morning. He was deep in conversation with Mr. Karras as we entered.
"What news, William?"
Mr. Brown asked.
"Packed your bags for a trip to the country?"
He wiped his hands on his apron and sent an apprentice for a bucket of ale. Grandfather banged his cane on the floor.
"I didn't run from the redcoats, and I won't run from a dockside miasma.
What is wrong with people, Andrew? We suffered all kinds of disease in our youth, but folks were sensible. They didn't squall like children and hide in the woods.
Mr. Karras cleared his throat.
If the yellow fever were a soldier, you'd run it through with your famous sword and sit down to a hearty dinner. But there may be cause for caution, old friend. Listen to the mayor's orders, which Andrew has just printed.
He picked up a broad sheet and read.
On advice from the College of Physicians. 1. All persons should avoid those that are infected. 2. The homes of the sick should be marked. 3. Sick people should be placed in the center of large, airy rooms without curtains and should be kept clean. 4. We must supply a hospital for the poor. 5. All bell tolling should cease immediately. 6. The dead should be buried privately. 7. The streets and wharves must be kept clean. 8. All persons should avoid fatigue of the body and mind. 9. All persons should avoid being in the sun, drafts, and evening air. 10. All persons should dress appropriately for the weather. 11. All persons should consume alcohol in moderation.
I'm glad they'll stop ringing the bells, I said.
Sensible advice, most of it,
Grandfather said.
Still, I don't understand why so many run scared. They've taken over a Ricketts Circus building on 12th Street to house the poor,
said Mr. Brown.
Isn't that why we have an almshouse?
Asked Grandfather.
The almshouse is closed. They want to protect their residents from the disease. So the fever victims lie on the floor of Ricketts with little water and no care. Once a day, they remove the bodies for burial. A neighbor threatened to burn the place down if the sick are not removed,
explained Mr. Karras.
But where will they go?
Asked Grandfather.
No one knows.
I hadn't heard about that. They were burying fever victims every day? How many have died, Mr. Karras? I asked. He turned to Mr. Brown.
How many dead, Andrew?
Mr. Brown shrugged.
It's hard to say with certainty. I've heard several hundred at least,
said Mr. Karras. Grandfather paused.
Even a few hundred isn't enough to call it an epidemic,
he said.
Some doctors warn we may see 1,000 dead before it's over. There are 40,000 people living in Philadelphia, William. Can you imagine if 1 in 40 were to die?
The room quieted as we all pondered the number.
I don't believe it,
said Grandfather finally.
People exaggerate. What news from our friend Evans?
Mr. Brown looked up.
His wife is ill, and he has closed his shop. My business dwindles daily. I have already lost one of my lads, gone with his family to Wilmington.
Mrs. Ogilvy said that everyone of fashion has fled to their country estates, I offered.
I heard one of her daughters was stricken, said Mr. Brown.
Myself, I straddle a fence. One foot stays here in Philadelphia. The other foot is in the country. We know the air there is pure and the people safer. I say safer, mind, not safe. There are reports of fever in Bucks County and Delaware. What of the government, then?
Grandfather asked.
Jefferson still comes into town every morning, though everyone says he'll soon quit and retire to his farm at Monticello,
said Mr. Karras.
Bah, we don't need Jefferson. We have the general. President Washington won't abandon us.
Mr. Karras blew his nose loudly.
The president retires to Virginia for a respite every September. He is not a man to change his habits. Even if he called the Congress back, few would dare return. I tell you, William, men who stood unafraid before British cannon run in fear from this foul pestilence. I fear for Philadelphia. I fear for the people. I fear for myself.
Grandfather did not say a word as we walked home. I silently counted on my fingers. 28 days until the end of September, then on into October until the first frost. Frost always killed fever. Mr. Karras said it drained the poison from the air. The Luddingtons were sounding better. Slopping pigs couldn't be that much harder than serving in the front room, and it would be better than falling ill or dying. I'd be there over harvest. They would make me work in the fields and feed me bread and water. But I wouldn't get sick. Grandfather stayed silent until we approached a limping man dressed in dark rags, pushing a cart.
"Wonder where that fellow's going,"
he said.
"Looks like he belongs on the waterfront."
A thin white arm flopped over the side of the cart as it jostled over the cobblestones.
"Hello there, good man,"
called Grandfather.
"There is no place for the dead up here. Hello?"
The man ignored us and pressed on steadily. "Perhaps he is transporting a poor woman to Ricketts Circus, like Mr. Karras said," I suggested.
"She should be moved at night, when good people are safe in their beds. Now what is he doing?"
The man had stopped at the corner of High and Seventh, in front of our coffee house. Grandfather sped up.
"Sir, I protest most vehemently."
I lifted my skirts and ran ahead of Grandfather. An unnamed fear shot through me. My eyes filled with tears.
"No, this is too much,"
Grandfather called angrily.
"Sir,"
he shouted,
"take that away from my home. Off with you now and take your cargo, or I should call the constable."
The man turned back and looked at Grandfather, then lifted the handles of the wheelbarrow and dumped the woman on the street.
"Mother!"
I screamed. Chapter 9. September 2nd, 1793. He's the best physician that knows the worthlessness of most medicines. Benjamin Franklin. Poor Richard's Almanac. 1733.
I stood dumbly while Grandfather knelt by Mother's side.
"She's alive,"
he said.
"Take her feet, Maddie. We must get her inside."
Eliza screamed as we carried Mother through the front door. She dropped a clay pitcher on the floor. It shattered into bits.
"Is she?"
"She was overcome by the heat,"
said Grandfather.
"She'll be fine after a short rest. That's all she needs, a short rest."
Mother didn't open her eyes until we tucked her into bed. She looked around in confusion.
"You fainted,"
Eliza explained.
"It's what you get for working too hard,"
added Grandfather. I waited for Mother to throw off the quilt and scold us. Instead, she shivered.
"I'll sleep a few moments, then I'll feel better," she said, patting my hand. "Go downstairs, Matilda. Be useful."
Something was desperately wrong. Mother was sleeping in the middle of the day. I wanted to stay and watch over her, but Eliza and Grandfather shooed me out of the room. There was no time to argue. A customer banged through the front door and called for something to drink. Nothing went right that afternoon. The coffee urn leaked. The biscuits burned in the oven. I dropped an entire drawer of tea leaves on the floor. The gentlemen were all quarrelsome and fractious. I snuck upstairs once, but Mother still slept. Eliza gave me what for when she caught me. As I cleared the dirty mugs off the last table, Grandfather stood deep in conversation with Mr. Rowley. I motioned to Eliza. "Isn't he a doctor?" I asked. Eliza shook her head.
"Not a proper physician, but he sees sick folk and prescribes medicines. All the real doctors are down on Water Street. It's been a terrible day there. They say bodies are piling up like firewood."
"I don't believe it."
"Shush,"
said Eliza.
"I heard it at the society. If Reverend Allen said it, you can believe it's the truth. Here they come."
Grandfather introduced Mr. Rowley. I curtsied.
Mr. Rowley here has vast experience treating female complaints, said Grandfather. He'll get Lucille back on her pins in no time.
I had my doubts. His hands were uncommonly dirty, and he smelled of rum. It seemed immodest to let a strange man into our bedchamber, but Grandfather and Eliza showed him in to see the patient. I followed close behind. He first took Mother's pulse, then felt the skin on her ankles and wrists, then peered down her throat and under her eyelids. He worked without a word, grunting occasionally, and making a tisking sound with his tongue. Mother did not wake. I wanted to throw a bucket of water in her face. It was against the laws of nature for her to lie in bed with the sun so high. At last, Rowley rose from the bed. We waited for him to speak, like a congregation expecting the minister's benediction.
"It is not yellow fever," he said.
Grandfather sighed in relief.
"But Dr. Rush says yellow fever is spreading everywhere," Eliza said.
"Dr. Rush likes to alarm people," Mr. Rowley replied. "There is a great debate about this pestilence. Yesterday, a physician I shall not name diagnosed yellow fever in an elderly woman. Her family threw her into the street. She died, but she didn't have yellow fever. It was all a mistake. I use the diagnosis sparingly, and I assure you, there is no fever in this house."
Grandfather beamed.
"See, Matilda, I was right. We have no cause to run out of the city like children scared by a ghost. Lucille will be scolding us by sunrise,"
he chuckled. Rowley wagged his finger at Grandfather.
"I wouldn't predict that," he said. "She'll need more than a good nap to recover. Be sure to bathe her every 4 hours and keep her clean and cool. I'll give some remedies to your servant. And now," he said, holding out his hand and showing his gray teeth, "my fee."
Giving my mother a bath felt upside down and backside front. I didn't want to do it. Daughters aren't supposed to bathe their mothers. But Eliza could not manage alone. We moved my bed to Grandfather's chamber and replaced it with the tin bathing tub. Every 4 hours we filled the tub with hot water mixed with black pepper and myrrh. The worst part was dragging Mother from her fitful sleep and getting her to sit in the water. The fever had taken hold of her senses, and she wept, calling my father's name. While Mother dozed in the tub, we stripped the linen from her bed and laid on fresh. She was supposed to drink Dittany tea, sweetened with molasses, but it tasted too horrible. As soon as we had her back in bed, Eliza emptied the tub and put more water on to boil. Mother shivered so hard her teeth rattled. Even with all the blankets in the house on her, she could not warm. She lay under the faded bedding like a rag doll losing its stuffing, her hair a wild collection of snakes on the pillow, her cornflower blue eyes poisoned with streaks of yellow and red. It hurt to look at her. After the sunset, Eliza set a candle by her bed.
"Your grandfather is sleeping at Old Man Karras's house," she explained.
"Just as well," I said. "Are you going home?"
"I must," she said. "My brother is expecting me."
I nodded. Eliza lived with her brother's family. They would be very worried if she didn't come home. "I'll be fine," I said. "I think she'll sleep through the night." Eliza kissed my forehead.
"Don't forget your prayers," she said. "I'll come early and try to bring a doctor with me."
After she left, I locked the doors and closed the shutters. A church bell struck 10 times, and I shivered. The coffee house was filled with shadows and dark noises. I took 2 extra candles from the clothes press and hurried upstairs to watch over Mother. She did not notice when I entered the room. Her face was pulled taut in pain, and she jerked in her sleep. I so wanted to touch her. The tops of her hands were roped with muscle and veins, but her skin was wrinkled and soft. Had she ever enjoyed anything? Had every day been a struggle? Perhaps death would be a release, a rest for the weary. A slight breeze waltzed through the room. Silas strolled in and jumped onto the bed. He settled himself so gently by her feet that she did not stir. No mice would disturb her. That was understood. Mother wrinkled her brow and moaned. I smoothed her hair. I'm here, Mother, I whispered. Be still. She shook her head from side to side on the pillow. Tears threatened again. I sniffed and tried to control my face. No one could ever tell what Mother thought or felt by looking at her. This was a useful trait. I needed to learn how to do it. There were so many things she had tried to teach me, but I didn't listen. I leaned over to kiss her forehead. A tear slipped out before I could stop it. I quietly sat beside her and opened my psalm book, praying for deliverance, or at least the dawn. I must have dozed off. One moment the room was still. The next, Mother flew off the pillows and was violently ill, vomiting blood all over the bed and floor. Her eyes rolled back in her head. I jumped up from the stool. Eliza! I screamed. Help! There was no answer. Eliza was gone. I was alone. I forced myself back to the bed. Mother panted heavily. Everything will be fine, I said as I sponged her face clean. Just lay still. Her eyes opened and I smiled at her. Tears pooled in her eyes and spilled down her cheeks. She opened her cracked lips.
Go away, she whispered. Leave me.
I recoiled as she leaned over the bed and retched a foul-smelling black fluid onto the floor. Oh, stop! Please stop! I begged.
Leave me!
Mother shouted in a ragged voice.
Leave me! Go!
I tried to help her back onto her pillows, but she pushed me away and shook her head.
Go away!
She repeated. I ran sobbing to the window. Breathing in the fresh air helped calm my stomach. The houses along the street were shuttered tight and dark. I had to help her. She was depending on me. Let me clean you up, I began as I turned away from the window. You'll feel better in a clean shift. Maybe a bath. Would you like a bath again? She was breathing as fast and heavy as a runaway horse. Her hand fumbled along the mucky sheet until it found the small book of psalms I had dropped. I'll put some water on to boil. Mother threw the book weakly at my head.
Out!
She croaked.
Don't want you sick. Go away!
Chapter 10. September 6th, 1793. The patient is to be placed in a large empty tub and two buckets full of water of the temperature 75 or 80 degrees Fahrenheit's thermometer are to be thrown on him. Dr. Adam Kuhn, Philadelphia, 1793. Eliza shook my shoulder. I woke at once with a sharp breath. Outside, the sky was turning pale gold. Mockingbirds were singing. Mother slept, her skin the color of an old weathered barn. At least she was alive. Your grandfather and I have found help, Eliza whispered. Dr. Kerr. He's educated, from Scotland. Dr. Kerr nodded to me. He was a small man wearing a black coat and carrying a small medical case. He set the case on the floor and opened Mother's eyelids with his fingers. She slept on. Where's Grandfather? I asked. Waiting downstairs, Eliza said.
How was she in the night?
Dr. Kerr asked as he started his examination. I did everything Mr. Rowley instructed. I bathed her and gave her tea. I tried to keep the bedclothes clean, but we'll wash today. She finally slept after midnight. Do you think she looks better? She feels a little cooler to me. Mr. Rowley said it was just an autumnal fever, nothing serious.
Eliza pulled me close to her.
Shh, she said gently. Dr. Kerr rose off the bed.
Damned fool,
he growled. Excuse me? I said.
Rowley, the imposter. Autumnal fever, indeed. Your mother has yellow fever. There's no doubt at all.
Yellow fever. My mouth moved, but I could not breathe. It made no sense. Mother wouldn't allow it. She had given birth to me in the morning and cooked supper for 10 that night. She survived the British occupation while my father fought with Washington's troops. Mother would beat back illness with a broom.
A loud moan interrupted my thoughts. Dr. Kerr laid his fingers on Mother's wrist.
Her pulse is fast and strong, he said. This is the crisis. She must be bled.
Dear God. Won't that weaken her more? I asked.
Bunkum,
Dr. Kerr said angrily.
Dr. Rush has proven that bleeding is the only way to save a patient this close to the grave.
But she could mend yet, Eliza said.
Dr. Kerr took a small lancet from his bag. It glinted in the sunlight. He handed me a basin and told Eliza to hold Mother's shoulders.
I felt faint.
Her pulse is full, quick, and tense,
he said, pushing up Mother's sleeve.
Hold the basin right against her arm. The pestilence boils within her blood and must be drained.
I flinched as the lancet flashed and blood from Mother's arm poured into the basin. Dr. Kerr handed me a second basin when the first was full. My stomach turned over, but I clenched my jaw and stood firm.
There,
he said finally. He bandaged the cut on her arm and rolled down her sleeve. Mother lay still and silent, but she was breathing.
That was 10 ounces of blood. I'll come back tomorrow to take another 10. She needs to purge the disease still in her stomach and bowels. She'll need 10 grains of jalap and 10 grains of calomel. It will be dirty work to care for her, but it should clean her system efficiently.
But she's so pale, I said. Can't the medicines wait a day or so?
Mother finally roused. She blinked her eyes and pointed at me.
Get her out,
she whispered.
Out!
A cough choked off the rest of her words. Dr. Kerr and Eliza struggled to calm her.
Go wait in the kitchen, Maddie, Eliza said.
She won't settle until you're gone. She doesn't want you here. She's afraid you'll get sick.
Dr. Kerr took me by the arm before I could protest. He led me down the stairs like a lamb on a string.
She doesn't want you to see the worst. You can help down here. I'm sure Eliza would appreciate a cup of tea. Lucille is a strong woman. With God's mercy, she will survive this peril.
Grandfather was waiting for us at the bottom of the stairs. Dr. Kerr got right to the point.
Yellow fever, William. There's no doubt. I advise you send Matilda out of the city at once.
What?
I asked. Grandfather sat heavily in a kitchen chair.
Lucille has been wanting her out of town.
No!
I stamped my foot on the floor.
You can't send me away! I need to be here! I need to help! You can't send me away!
Dr. Kerr frowned.
I understand, Matilda. These are difficult days for us all. Sensible people have turned mad overnight. They're rinsing their clothes in vinegar and wearing tarred ropes around their necks. This is no place for a young girl like you.
I wiped my eyes on my sleeve. Why can't Mother come with me? Wouldn't it be better for her in the country air?
No town will let her in, explained Dr. Kerr. They turn all fever victims away.
Your cook can care for your mother. Your grandfather can travel with you. This is the best for all.
Grandfather tried to smile.
We'll make it an adventure, lass.
He turned as Eliza came down the steps carrying filthy sheets.
I've explained to Matilda that she'll be leaving, Dr. Kerr said.
"'Tis best," Eliza said.
"'I advise you to hire a wagon as soon as possible,' Dr. Kerr said. He picked up his medical case. "'They're scarce as hen's teeth. Remember to tie a yellow cloth to the front railing. This coffee house is officially closed.'
As he closed the door behind him, I started to argue.
"'We haven't heard from the Ludingtons. I can't turn up without an invitation.' Let me stay one more day, Eliza. Grandfather, surely you understand.
We want to keep you safe, lass,
Grandfather said as he pulled himself to his feet. He paused to cough, then put on his hat.
I'm off to find us a coach.
This could not be happening. They were sending me off, sending me away to strangers. You'll let me stay, won't you, Eliza?
Eliza swung the kettle over the fire to boil.
Maddie, you are like kin to me, as is your mother. I can't let you stay here. Lucille doesn't want it, and neither do I.
Her face was grim and set in a way I had never seen before. No amount of cajoling would change her mind.
I'll pack a hamper of food for your trip, she said.
She paused by the sideboard to pick something up.
I nearly forgot. This was by the front door when I came in.
It's addressed to you.
Who would send anything to me?
The parcel was flat and as large as my hand. I fumbled with the brown paper, trying to unwrap it carefully so we could use the paper again. Eliza looked over my shoulder and made an approving noise.
Mm-mm-mm.
It was a painting. A vase full of delicate flowers, bright blue, lavender, and red, carefully painted on a scrap of wood. The flowers looked alive, like they would move if a breeze stirred through the kitchen. Eliza rummaged through the wrapping paper.
Here, she said. He sent a note. Maddie, I write you in haste. Master Peel is closing up the house with his family and assistants inside. To protect us from the fever. We have water from the well and food stored. My thoughts race. These flowers are for you. Take good care, Maddie. I would not want you sick. We shall watch for balloons again when this plague has passed. N.B.
Morning came too quickly, and it was time to leave.
Maddie, the wagon is here!
Eliza called. It was hard to tell which would collapse first, the wagon or the horse pulling it. The farmer and his wife sat up front, holding a baby with dried snot across its face. Grandfather rode in the back, waving triumphantly. Eliza eyed the horse with doubt.
It's a beauty, isn't it?
He bellowed. The horse stopped in front of the coffee house, puffing and wheezing. The farmer jumped down to load my valise and food hamper into the back of the wagon. Grandfather headed into the house.
Be out in a tick,
he promised. He was acting like we were headed for a lark instead of fleeing an epidemic. I shook my head. It wouldn't do to be angry. I hugged Eliza one last time. She muttered a quiet blessing and tucked a lock of hair into my cap.
You stay out there until two hard frosts, she warned. Promise me that.
Yes, ma'am, I answered. Thank you, Eliza. Thank you for everything. You've done so much.
I couldn't choke out anything else. She hugged me tighter.
Hush, child. I'm doing no more than your mother would do in my place. This is how the Lord wants us to treat each other. She'll be fine, and we both know it. Don't worry about her. You take care of yourself.
She turned me around and gave me a shove toward the wagon.
Thought you said the old man was coming,
the farmer said as he tied down the valise.
Have patience, I said. Here he comes.
Grandfather stepped onto the porch dressed in his regimental jacket, his sword buckled onto his belt, and King George on his shoulder. He saluted.
Captain William Farnsworth Cook, Pennsylvania 5th Regiment, here to escort you beyond the lines of the dread and terrible enemy, Yellow Fever, Miss Matilda.
He clicked his boots together and offered his arm to me. Eliza laughed as she wiped her eyes with her apron. Grandfather helped me climb up into the wagon before hoisting himself aboard with a grunt. King George circled overhead and squawked. The farmer yelled, "Giddy up!" and cracked the whip across the back of the horse. And so I left home, in a manner quite unpredicted. Chapter 11, September 7th, 1793. Great numbers of the citizens have shut up their houses and fled into the country. Letter of Ebenezer Hazard, Philadelphia, 1793. With only one half-starved horse pulling us, it took nearly an hour to be clear of the city line. The dry road was rutted from the wagons and carriages which had fled before us. The insects were vicious. I smacked them on my arms and legs until my skin stung. Grandfather took out his handkerchief and mopped sweat off his face and neck. I waved away a mosquito that buzzed in my ear. "It's the smell of that baby," I said. "His drawers are full, and it's attracting every bug for miles." Grandfather chuckled. The laughter caught in his throat and made him cough. I watched with alarm as his face reddened. I pounded his back until he raised his arm in protest.
"I'm fine, child, I'm fine. No need to beat me senseless."
The farmer turned around in his seat and glared at him.
"He ain't sick, is he? I'll not have fever victims in my wagon."
"Take care you don't drive off the road. We're fine back here. Mind your horse," I snapped.
Grandfather raised an eyebrow.
"You're turning into a regular scold, Matty Cook. You sound like your mother ordering menfolk around."
"Some menfolk need ordering."
"That they do."
He straightened his legs as best he could between the baskets and clothing bundles.
"I propose we enjoy our carriage ride in the country. It would hardly be proper to remove my coat, but if I can beg my lady's indulgence, I will unfasten a button or two."
His stiff fingers fumbled with the pewter buttons until they released and he could breathe with ease.
"There,"
he sighed.
"That's better. It's time to review your soldiering lessons."
I groaned. From my crawling days, Grandfather had taught me all the tricks of the American and the British armies, and quite a few from the French. Again and again and again. It would do no good to argue. I was his captive.
"A soldier needs three things to fight,"
he continued. He held up three fingers and waited for my response. "One, a sturdy pair of boots," I said. "Two, a full belly. Three, a decent night's sleep." Grandfather thunked his boots on the floorboards.
"Hey!"
protested the farmer.
"My boots are sound."
Grandfather belched.
"Tisk, tisk," said the farmer's wife.
"Eliza fed me breakfast enough for two blacksmiths."
He pulled the brim of his hat down over his eyes and settled back against a rolled-up mattress.
"And now I'm going to get some sleep before our coachman delivers us unto the joys of the Luddington family barnyard and their odoriferous pigs."
"Pigs!"
echoed King George. I settled in alongside him so my head rested on his chest. The rhythmic turning of the wagon wheels, the hum of insects in the barley fields along the road, and the beat of Grandfather's heart blended into a lullaby. I woke when the wheels stopped turning. I had to shield my eyes from the sun. Why are we stopping? I asked. The farmer didn't answer, but pointed up the road. The baby cried. Four horsemen, armed with muskets, blocked our way.
Robbers! I felt